and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I'm recording this late on Thursday because tomorrow I leave for Texas. We are going to go try and catch the eclipse. I'm very happy to be going with the group that I'm going with. It's the same folks that I went on vacation with down in the Caribbean in February. And we all agreed we would all do this thing together. You know, I like these guys. At the same time, I'm pretty bummed because this would be like the perfect thing for us to take our Sprinter van to go do. And I'm even more bummed because it looks like, as of least last time we checked, the weather is going to suck across the entire path of totality, like blowing up my life. Happy to see these guys, but blowing up my life for 4 days to see an eclipse that we're not going to be able to see is just going to kind of stink. But we'll see. But I'm just harried for time. I got to write a G file tomorrow before I get on a plane or while I'm on the plane. And I hadn't realized I hadn't taken the notify the LA Times. I was going to take the column off. So now I got to do the column while I'm on the trip. And I also hadn't realized I've been very, very busy. Lots of stuff, personal, professional going on. And I hadn't focused on the fact that I don't have a remnant lined up or in the can, and I'm going to be flying back on Tuesday. So Dom, if I don't talk to you before you listen to this, we got to figure something out there. Maybe we'll just get a substitute host. And where to begin? I've not followed the news super closely today. Although I got to say, we did, because Steve and Sarah were out, we did a dispatch pod with me where I was hosting. It's weird. I don't, at this point, mind hosting my own podcast where it's a conversation. There's still things about it I don't love that don't come naturally to me. But I really don't like moderating panels or group podcasts. I don't think I'm bad at it. There's something about it that doesn't come naturally to me. And so I always sort of, I'm happy to have somebody else moderate, but I moderated. I think I did okay. And we had me, Kevin, Mike Warren, and special guest star, Megan McArdle, who I am an enormous fan of, one of the smartest people I know. And just saying, you know, if for any reason, she were ever looking for a new job, we would love to talk to her about it. I've told her that in person quite a few times. Anyway, I believe she's very happy at the Washington Post. I'm not trying to float any rumors or anything like that. I'm just saying that I think she's an immensely talented person. And we talked about a bunch of stuff. And I highly recommend that podcast if you're looking for on point punditry. I won't repeat all of it. I also, since I'm in the, I feel it's not quite Santa sending people to Gimbel's and Miracle on 34th Street. But I have to say that the latest two advisory opinions podcasts this week were really pretty good. The first one, which I thought got off to a little bit of a shaky start, is with three judges who just got back from a junket to Israel or a special trip to Israel. Once they get cooking, it's really very, very good on the law of war stuff, on what Israel's really like and really about, what constitutes a nation. There's this riff, I want to say, around the 40-minute mark by one of the judges that I think is extremely useful. So I highly recommend that. And then I just listened today because I've been driving around doing all these errands. I got a lot of stuff going on. I listened to most of the second AO podcast this week where they talked about a bunch of different arguments about the threat to the conservative legal movement. I can't really do justice to all the different angles. We had a very good piece on the site by Greg Nunziata about this, which was one of the things that sparked it. A lot of disagreement, a lot of agreement. But if you're interested in that stuff, I think it's worth listening to. There's one point that David made that I agree with entirely. You know, there was weird. They all basically agree the conservative legal movement is got real problems. But not necessarily the ones that its critics on the sort of center right lay out. Sarah makes a point that the Federalist Society still has its original leadership, and organizations always have a rocky time when the founding when the founders leave and new leadership comes in, and that's one thing. And there are other reasons why the Federalist Society is, there are reasons to be concerned. But David made a point that I think is spot on insofar as, and this is a point I've made, David's made a bunch of times, but like, you know, the Federalist Society guys, you know, Steve Tellez in his book, right? The Against Trump or Anti-Trump or Never Trump book. I can't remember what it's called. And he wrote it with a co-author who I can't remember his name. I apologize to everybody. I'm a little frazzled. But Steve Tellez made this point, and I've quoted it often, that of all the different factions on the right, the ones who got out the most scathed from the Trump presidency, most unscathed, I should say, in terms of maintaining their status and their integrity and their influence, was the conservative legal movement, you know, essentially the Federalist Society and you know, aligned groups. Certain individuals saw their careers and their reputations absolutely demolished, but that wasn't the fault of the conservative legal movement. That was the fault of people like John Eastman and that Jeff Clark guy. But on the whole, the Federalist Society types, the Federalist judges that Trump appointed, including to the Supreme Court, they did not reveal themselves to be partisan hacks. They did not reveal themselves to be pretextualists in the sense that, you know, they were only saying that they believed this stuff for purposes of getting into power and all that kind of thing, and didn't actually plan on applying their principles when they conflicted with, you know, partisan interest. That just didn't happen. The Supreme Court was not Donald Trump's friend in all of the election stuff, nor were any of the conservative Federal Society type judges that he appointed to the lower courts. They kind of handed Trump's lawyers their ass time and time again. You know, David talks about, you know, is it David Pryor, Stephen Pryor, you know, the judge in the Southeastern District, I think he's out of Georgia, who's on Trump's short list to be a Supreme Court justice. You know, his incentives were, political incentives were pretty well aligned to be sympathetic to Trump, and he basically shut him down. Anyway, Steve Tellez's argument, which I think is right, I don't know if it's all explanatory, but one of the reasons why the Federalist Society types, the legal conservative types, weathered all the dislocations and pressures of the Trump era, or I should say Trump era part one, is they had all sorts of rules, mechanisms, you know, psychological habits that were garnered from the fact that they're lawyers, right? And that lawyers have transactional relationships with their clients. They have rules about the kinds of arguments they will make. They have rules about telling the truth, about adhering to facts. They're officers of the court. And so, you know, I have a lot of lawyer friends. I know that doesn't necessarily reflect well on me. And some of them are really crappy people as clients. And while, you know, we can gainsay this client or that client, on the whole, you know, I wouldn't be friends with them if I didn't think they had integrity. And they do, because they know how to stay kind of distant and not get too invested and sell themselves wholly and completely over to the causes of their client. That Jeff Clark guy did, John Eastman did, Rudy Giuliani did. But I think they're essentially exceptions to the rule, and their careers and reputations are in tatters because of it. But most everybody else that I can think of, you know, whether they were judges or White House counsels or Justice Department officials, they can hold their heads high as far as I can tell. I'm sure I'm forgetting some individual here or there, but I think I'm on pretty solid ground about the generalization. And anyway, so back to David's point. David's point was, or is, that the Federalist Society has a real problem culturally or politically, insofar as of recently, it has become, you know, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, if you're a conservative, if you're a Republican, and you want to be a judge someday or have the option of being a judge someday, being a professor, being a Justice Department official, that kind of thing, the Federalist Society is a great professional society to belong to. It's a great network of people to know. It is a shiny star on your resume for, you know, for the nomination process or the confirmation process and all that. The problem they have now is in part because in Trump era part one, they maintained their integrity. The MAGA right does not like them anymore. And I think that, you know, the common good constitutionalism stuff is as a political force is pretty overblown and was dealt a pretty bad blow by Dobbs. But the MAGA crowd, you know, I mean, you have people quoted in the New York Times who are part of that Project 2025 thing, you know, all that stuff, saying that, you know, the era of the Federalist Society types is over. One of those guys said, you know, we need judges who, quote, know what time it is. And you've been saying this in the New York Times, and that's, you've heard me talk about this before, I've written about it before. Know what time it is this really idiotic, juvenile, somewhat unpatriotic and anti-American and anti-democratic shibboleth, code word, you know, password, catchphrase, whatever, that implies this a whole argument about how America's institutions are rotted and corrupt and need to be swept away and replaced with men of will who and men of strength and literally men who lift, like lift weights, and people who recognize this, that we are in sort of Weimar America and recognize that we need to either hasten the collapse of these institutions or completely take them over, disregarding sort of procedural liberalism and all that kind of stuff, and assert will and manly strength to save this country with nationalism and Trumpism and blah, 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 blah. If it doesn't come across that I have contempt for all of this, I apologize. I have contempt for all of it. The problem for the Federalist Society, again, which is David's original point, is that it's never been in that position, right? It has always been in a position where it got the, I don't want to say unquestioning, you know, but it got the sort of automatic respect and support from the broader intellectual right, which I think it still mostly does, but also the sort of journalistic media right, and also the Republican Party, like, you know, promising to appoint justices and judges from approved by the Federalist Society was something that you could brag about at a campaign rally. Even when the Federalist Society was not necessarily a conduit to a great legal career, when it was a riskier proposition to join, it was still popular across the broad, you know, landscape of the right. And now, because I know I'm a broken record on this, the definition of being a real Republican and not being a rhino or a squish or a cuck or a sellout or any of those things is your full-throated, often manly support for whatever Donald Trump wants, right? In a world where Chip Roy is a rhino because he was insufficiently loyal to Donald Trump in a primary, then rhino has no other meaning other than slavish lickspittle to Donald Trump. And there are a lot of people who vote in primaries, who give to politicians, who have outsized voices on not just Fox News, but, you know, on Newsmax and Bannon Media and Daily Signal and Daily Wire and Daily Caller and all that world. Heritage Foundation and institutionally has gone that way. I feel so sorry for Ed Meese. And so for a lot of people who, let me put it this way. Since I didn't have a lot prepared, we can kind of do this as a greatest hits thing. Right. The Yuval Levin point about institutions that they mold you, right? That they bend you to the institutional mores and interests of the organization for your own betterment and the betterment of the organization. And hopefully, if it's a rightly ordered institution, the betterment for your community or your American society writ large, right? Healthy institutions and a pluralistic, diverse society are good for the whole society, even if you don't want the values of an individual institution to be the values of the whole country, right? We don't want the whole country to have the exact same values as, say, Catholic monastery. But it's good to have Catholic monasteries out there. It's good to have sticky institutions that bind people to a diverse set of rules and obligations because it creates more nooks and crannies for people to find personal happiness. It expands the empathetic imagination of society generally. and it makes this country a more interesting place to drive across. And so, but the point is that institutions have to have a certain amount of internal coherence that is at some variance with just the mainstream culture. There has to be something that makes institutions distinct. And some institutions are more distinct than other institutions because they have different missions, right? You know, we do not want the Marines to have the exact same values and mission as, Greenpeace, right? Or the Shriners, or bowling leagues. We want the Marines to be Marines, but we also don't want bowling leagues to be like the Marine Corps. And anyway, the Federalist Society, what one of the functions that it performed was that it took young, ambitious, smart conservatives who weren't necessarily philosophically committed to movement conservatism, and it baptized them into the arguments of, you know, originalism and textualism and all that kind of stuff. And the incentives and interests were aligned in such a way that you didn't feel like embracing this stuff was in conflict with your other ambitions. The more the GOP becomes magnified and nationalistic and populist and unconstrained by philosophical and principled commitments, joining the Federalist Society is not necessarily consistent with all of your career ambitions. And I don't know that they have any muscle memory for dealing, well, I don't think they have any real muscle memory for dealing with that kind of environment, because that is new on the right and that'll shake things up. And so, you know, a lot of the institutions that got wrecked or corrupted or had the wind knocked out of them, but then got up and recovered, we don't have to put names to all of them, or completely changed their philosophical and professional orientations to be consistent with the latest fad, that is the Trumpified GOP, that all happened already. There are very few institutions left that are struggling to deal with the pressures of Trumpism. They've figured it out. I mean, I'm not saying that there won't be new challenges should he get elected, you know, for, you know, various conservatives and conservative media outlets and conservative institutions. But, you know, we've been through this, the great jostling, because the Federalist Society emerged intact in large part. It doesn't have as much experience to deal with what happens when the Trumpified GOP and the populist right says, yeah, you guys are cucks. We don't need you people anymore. That's a bad political climate to encounter at precisely the time your existing leadership is aging out. And I don't mean this in any way as a derogatory thing about the Federalist Society. You know, I know some of those guys who've been running that place. I like them. I respect them. But, like, they're not going to be the president or the vice president or the executive director or whatever of the Federalist Society for another 20 years. It's going to be a patchy time. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting. Do check those podcasts out. Okay, so let's take a second to hear from our sponsor, Aura Frames. Longtime listeners know I'm a big fan of Aura Frames. I've gotten them as gifts. I've given them as gifts. I sent my daughter back to college with one so she could look at many, many, many pictures of her cat and I guess her parents as well. So if you're looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life, Aura Frames are a beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. I can attest, it is very easy to use, very intuitive. You don't have to read a lot of documentation. And it's just like you load the app and it says, what pictures do you want in your frame? And you put them in your frame and you can change them and you can set the settings to whatever you want for how long the pictures stay there. It's pretty idiot proof. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com, A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use the promo code REMNANT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. I kind of feel like I am supposed to or need to write something about this, you know, the World Central Kitchen tragedy, disaster, mistake, you know, pick your labels. I do think it's terrible. I think it's sad. I got a lot of grief for saying on Twitter that I think what Jose Andres is saying is wrong and terrible, but I think he's a good person who's probably just letting his grief and shock speak too loudly for him. But barring some new evidence, I tend to still believe that. I mean, I think he's a big lefty guy and I probably disagree with him on a bunch of things. And, you know, he likes being famous and all that kind of stuff, but he's doing good things, you know, for the most part. And, you know, feeding people in disaster areas and in war zones is a good thing. And I respect him, you know, to have the courage of his convictions and all of that. But this idea that Israel deliberately killed these people, which is a way of saying they murdered them, right? I mean, if we know that they're innocent, we know they're not members of Hamas, we know they're not combatants. The idea that Israel said, oh, look, that's the convoy from World Central Kitchen, let's kill them. It's a hugely grotesque and I think wildly implausible charge. Sure, the person who pulled the trigger or the person who ordered the pulling of the trigger intentionally shot at that convoy, but I don't think they intentionally shot at that convoy with the knowledge that what they were doing was killing a bunch of staffers from World Central Kitchen. And that doesn't mean there aren't people who should be held accountable or culpable. We need to know the facts, you know, and there's going to be an investigation. I don't expect a whitewash from Israel about this. I'm not saying people need to go to jail. I'm not saying that people don't need to go to jail. We just don't know. But, you know, it feels a bit to me like the apocryphal or the cop who is going into a building because he's heard shots fired or is responding to a call and some kid, you know, this happens in Hollywood a lot and I think it's happened in real life too. Some kid with a toy gun comes out from behind a corner. The cop who shoots him did it intentionally, but he didn't do it knowingly, right? He didn't do it with the intent of killing, in effect, an unarmed kid. It's just he was responding to events in the moment poorly. And that's why we have, you know, in the law, distinctions between negligent homicide and first degree murder. It's also why we have, you know, notions of, you know, partial sovereign immunity, not sovereign immunity, but you know what I'm talking about. It's weird how so many people are determined to believe that this is just something that Israel would do because this is who they are, while at the same time, normally when Israel does something or when something happens that this crowd doesn't like, they credit or blame Israel for it because of some scenario where Israel benefits, right? It's this cui bono kind of argument. And often the cui bono arguments are, although I like it better in the Italian, che paga, who pays? You know, the arguments from these who benefits things usually ascribe to Israel this all-knowing, all-seeing mastery of events. And if you believe that Israel did this intentionally, tell me how Israel benefits from this. Tell me how this works to Israel's benefit in any way, you know, or is it just like when they do something terrible by accident, it's still on purpose. And when they do something on purpose, you're just going to come up with an explanation for why it's terrible. I mean, is it just Israel can never win kind of thing? Anyway, I'll think through this more and I'll try to write about a little bit about this tomorrow. What else? Oh, so I was in my cigar shop today briefly. They had Fox News on and I saw this Chyron, this, you know, the TV was on mute, but they were talking the Chyron that, you know, which Chyron is like the lower third, you know, like headline about the topic kind of thing. I don't always know that if my TV lingo translates for people. They were talking, the headline was media pounces Trump's immigrant animal comment. Or animal immigrant comment or something like that. He called the illegal immigrants at the border animals or filthy animals or something like that. I mean, I think everyone listening can believe he said something like that. Anyway, that was the quote. And what I just thought was funny about it was, first of all, I know I talk about this a lot, but I did warn it was going to be a greatest hits thing. There were two things that were funny about the media pounce thing. One was the word media and the other was the word pounce. Fox and the vast majority of the American right, and I do it myself. I'm not exculpating, you know, excluding myself from this. It's a verbal and mental habit. But we talk about the media, and it always means the part of the media that we don't like, right? It's the mainstream media. It's the liberal media. Like the idea that Fox News is outside of this thing called the media is just so like, by almost from any angle except this sort of it's code for the bad guys, it's just ludicrous. I mean, like Fox News is the highest rated cable channel, has been forever, for 20 years or something like that. It is essentially the most powerful media outlet in red America by far. There's just no disputing that. And so this, you know, looking down their nose at the media, look what the media is doing. I just find that kind of bizarrely tedious and weird. And then there's the word pounce. Look, I'm a big believer in beating up on the media, on the mainstream media, on the legacy media, whatever, liberal media, for the use of Republicans' pounce. It is a ancient formulation, an ancient complaint. It's, you know, again, I do it. I will defend it, but it is a kind of lazy, hackish bit of punditry to harp on this. Doesn't mean it's not true. It just means it's kind of played out because it's been done so many times. It's like there are certain, I don't want to get anyone in specific. I shouldn't name anybody on this, but people can probably guess. You know, there are certain syndicated columnists. I honestly don't know if they're still writing, but who. It was like they had an algorithm or a computer program or a Google News alert or something that looked for some public school somewhere teaching something scary or insulting to Christians. And they would just write that column. Every fourth column would just be, aren't you outraged by this event? Doesn't mean you shouldn't be outraged by it. But it's just sort of like plug and play, lazy writing. And it kind of reminds me when the Spinal Tap, where the guests had a guest appearance on The Simpsons, and I think it's Nigel Tufnel, the lead singer guy. He had to have crib notes on the back of his guitar where he curated his standard routine that he says at every single concert so that it resonated with the residents of Springfield. So he was like, I was driving today on route, and he looks behind his guitar, 270. And everyone's like, oh, that's by my house, you know? and I saw a sign, blah, 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 blah. It's, you know, they don't rock as hard as we do in Springfield and Shelbyville, and everyone goes kind of crazy. And like, there's a certain kind of punditry that is a little bit like that, where it's such an easy topic that you kind of fall into it. And some people, they turn it into like their whole shtick. And so the Republicans pounce thing is one of these things, because, and it's a perfectly legitimate point where when Democrats do something or liberals do something or progressive icons do something that is legitimately outrageous or scandalous or controversial on the merits, what the AP or Reuters or whatever, you know, what they'll do is they'll translate it into Republicans pounce on so-and-so's comments, or for a while they changed it to Republicans seize on Biden's this or that. And it's a way of framing things that those people have a problem with this thing, but objective people don't. And then when some Republican does something terrible or stupid or controversial or whatever, the controversy is the controversy. It's not Democrats pounce, at least maybe not until the second or third day story. It's, can you believe what Marjorie Taylor Greene said? Can you believe what Donald Trump said? Can you believe, you know, what Republicans in Alabama are doing? But when it's Democrats in New York State, it's Republicans pounce on what Democrats are doing in New York State. It's that formulation. And so I just think it's kind of funny that when the former president and de facto GOP nominee running for president, using what up until a few years ago would be considered just beyond the pale and grotesque rhetoric, Fox can't say that it's bad in and of itself. It's got to be media pounces on this. If anybody sees future examples of this, let me know, because I just think it's kind of funny and it would be kind of a fun column to write. Can you guys hear my dogs howling up there? Well, it's not like you can answer me. Oh, this has just been a bee in my bonnet. I don't know if this 60 Minutes Der Spiegel insider story is true. We had Michael Weiss, who's one of the lead authors of it, on Dispatch Live this week. I haven't listened to that yet, but it certainly seems very plausible and definitely worth investigating. This report that the Havana Syndrome stuff was the result of a program by special operatives of Russia, and this unit 29155 of the GRU. I don't think it's a slam dunk yet, but there is evidence to believe that at least some of the cases were deliberate attacks on important American personnel in various places with essentially like an energy weapon that screwed up people's brains and gave them all sorts of health problems. Again, I think it's a serious allegation. You know, Der Spiegel, I've come to learn, is kind of a knee-jerky lefty publication these days. And so I think it's perfectly legitimate to sort of do more due diligence on it. It would be good if the New York Times or the Washington Post or some other, or the Dispatch, you know, subscribe and we'll have the resources to do more of that kind of stuff, could, you know, add to the story. But I certainly think it's plausible that Russia did it. You know, Russia has used, you know, outrageous chemical weapons to murder people in the UK and elsewhere. It is adept and perfectly comfortable with political assassinations, and not to mention torture, illegal wars, and all sorts of other things. So I certainly think it's possible that if they have this technology, that they would use it for, you know, what they've alleged to have used it for. Anyway, J.D. Vance, immediately when this story was breaking, long before he had any time to sort of like do any due diligence on it, he goes on Twitter. And so the original tweet was from Michael Weiss, who's the main reporter on this. And he says, a year-long investigation by Insider, 60 Minutes, and Der Spiegel has uncovered evidence suggesting that Havana Syndrome may have its origins in the use of directed energy weapons wielded by the Russian GRU's infamous unit 29155. And we can put a link to that stuff in the show notes. Vance retweets that by saying, feels like a lot of journalists have lost their minds. And then in a follow-up tweet, he says, have you guys heard that Putler, working with Drumpf and the saucer people, has started attacking with invisible lasers? And I think it's just stupid, not funny, irresponsible, immature, kind of embarrassing. And so did Noah Rothman, my friend, formerly of Commentary, now at National Review, where he's doing a great job. And he did... with the earnestness that we've all come to associate with Noah, a very earnest, good, long corner post about this. You know, the title of it was, an alleged attack on the United States isn't the time for snark. The only thing I would sort of add to this, because I remember listening to him about this on the editor's podcast about it, is my reaction to that is the snark is not the result of him actually not believing the story. I think the snark is the result of him being scared that the story is true. I think it's one of these ways to sort of send a signal to his world, to the Trump campaign, that he can reliably fight the fight against any negative messaging about Putin and Russia that would hurt Trump, that would hurt Vance as well. He does not want any people who are on the fence to be convinced that Russia is actually as evil and as malign as it actually is. And so this is a I think it's less sort of have fun snarkiness than it is a sign of his fear that the story is true and it's water carrying for Russia. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And I should also just say, like, even if it is snark, this is a guy who's perfectly comfortable with the Marjorie Taylor wing of the Republican Party, right? And Marjorie Taylor Greene, she didn't do a year-long investigation where they got intelligence officials on the record, did, you know, all sorts of due diligence, geolocation work or anything like that, when she just sort of freelanced that, you know, the Rothschilds were using space-based energy weapons to start wildfires. And the idea that somehow he has this sort of dripping scorn and snark for, again, what may not end up being a 100% accurate story. I don't know, but I find it pretty persuasive and believable and definitely worth looking into. And it definitely seems like they put in their home. They did their homework. He's got scorn and mockery for a real journalistic investigation, but what are you going to do? Who cares? Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she's pro-Trump, so she's okay. No enemies to my right kind of stuff. I know there are a lot of people who still think that Vance is a truly serious and honorable politician. I find it very difficult to see most of the time these days. And this is not the kind of thing that is going to convince me to get off of that position. Okay, what else? How long have I gone here? Not that I don't love talking to you. I just, brain's going 1,000 different directions. So I don't like dunking on people in the comments section. And I'm not, that's not really my intent here. I just do think it's funny that, so I wrote this, my LA Times column, which is up at the Dispatch, about how, well, basically it was to take a swipe at Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who I think is a fraud and a charlatan and is obviously trying to hurt Biden, which he's perfectly free and fine to do, right? That's what third parties do, is they have to pick which party they're going to hurt. I just have very little patience for his claims that he's doing something other than that. You know, the biggest donor to Robert F. Kennedy's super PAC, I think it's called American Values, is also the biggest donor to Trump's main super PAC. I can't remember the name of that, but who cares? This is guy Timothy Mellon of the Mellon family. That's not a coincidence, nor is it a coincidence that Robert Kennedy Jr. is using a lot of Trump's biggest and most dearly held talking points about how Biden is the real threat to democracy and questioning elections is just something that people do, which he should know since he was an election denier before it was cool. He claimed that the 2004 presidential election was stolen by the Republicans through all sorts of chicanery. But the point I made was that, or part of the point, or the relevant point for this point I'm about to make, and maybe I can say point a few more times, is that there's never been a time in my lifetime where the desire for a third party candidate has been stronger, and the argument for it on paper has never been stronger. When you just look at how 60, 70% of the American people don't want to vote for either of these guys, when you look at the discontent about, you know, among, you know, a lot of traditional Republican voters and a lot of members of the Democratic base for their, you know, their nominees, for the general weakness of both parties and their inability and unwillingness to embrace a strategy where they're majority parties, it is so ripe for one of them to go the way of the Whigs. The problem is that in the abstract, there's a huge desire for a third party candidate or an independent candidate, right? Whatever. Let's just use those terms synonymously. But when you actually come up with an actual flesh and blood human, an actual potential viable candidate, huge numbers of the people who desperately want a third party candidate goes, whoa, I didn't mean that. You know, there are lots of people, you know, John Huntsman would give his eye teeth to be President of the United States and to be a successful third party candidate. The problem is nobody wants him. Nobody wants, you know, not enough people want Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema or Robert F. Kennedy. He cannot win a general election. He can cause one of the two candidates to win a general election. I'm not saying he will, but that's definitely within the realm of possible. And he's opted that he would rather be helpful to Donald Trump than to Joe Biden. But it just gets to this point that, like, you know, we've done a lot of reporting at the Dispatch about No Labels, and, you know, the gist of what's been happening at No Labels is that these meetings with candidates, which got reported at most outlets, you know, Chris Christie or whoever interviewing to be the No Labels candidate, the reality was more like the reverse, where No Labels was interviewing with these candidates to see if they'd be willing to be their guy. it was, you know, the selling wasn't like, pick me, I can be your third party candidate. I can be your no labels guy. It was no labels saying, please, please do this and we can help you out. And I'm not saying that's true in every single case. I don't want to, you know, get ahead of the reporting, but this is my understanding of it from people I've talked to and people, you know, and stuff that we've reported. It just turns out that the abstract third party candidate is not, there is no person who scratches all those itches. I mean, look, I have an enormous respect for Liz Cheney. I'd be very happy to have Liz Cheney as president of the United States. But Liz Cheney does not put together a coalition that can defeat, that can rob enough voters from both the Democrats and the Republicans to become president of the United States. And so then you have to ask, okay, if the point is not to actually win an election, what would you say you do here? What is your point? What is your mission, your purpose of being a third party candidate? And we can gussy it up and talk about how nobody owns anybody's votes and, you know, it's a democracy and all that kind of stuff. But as a, just a practical politics matter, your job is to be a spoiler. And, you know, the problem for Liz Cheney, again, who, you know, I really do like and I consider to be a friend. I'm not as close to her as some friends of mine, but, you know, I'm a big fan. I was a huge fan of her father's. The problem is that she's too principled in her conservatism for Democrats, and she's too principled in her ethics for Republicans. And so, you know, I mean, she would be, if we were going to launch a remnant party, she might be our first nominee, but we're not doing that. And so anyway, I made this point. I think I'm entirely correct. There is no perfect person. You know, it's like, remember in the Brady Bunch, Greg Brady becomes a rock star because he fits the suit that the promoters wanted him to wear. That was also sort of the premise of this pretty bad, at least if memory serves, Clint Eastwood movie where he's a fighter pilot. He's going to steal a Soviet jet. And it turns out that the main qualification for him was that he fit the flight suit. Anyway, we can talk about that another time. There's no one to fit the suit. There's no one out there. I mean, like, I think Tom Hanks or Matthew McConaughey or someone like that could conceivably parachute in as a third party candidate and win? Maybe. I'd have to look at numbers and stuff, and you have to look at states and the Electoral College and all that. But as it stands, anyway, I didn't mean to summarize the whole column, and I didn't even get into the monkey paw thing, which was a big part of it. But one of the commenters said in the response to it, this is weak tea. No labels is going to come up with a candidate. And we can always write in Ben Sass. And I agree. I'll probably write in Ben Sass. You know, Mitch Daniels had his turn as my write-in guy. I might write in Liz Cheney. I don't know. Again, I vote in Washington, D.C. I have the luxury of voting my aspirations. But found out today that No Labels is simply not going to have a candidate at all because they can't find anybody willing to do it that would... Either, I mean, I haven't read all their statements. I'm sure they don't say it this way that, you know, they couldn't find anyone to do it who wouldn't hand the presidency to Donald Trump. But knowing some of the people involved with that stuff, knowing some of the donors, the excitement around the idea around No Labels was not to ensure that Donald Trump could be president of the United States. And here we are. And so I have no principal problem with, I want to be clear about this just to sort of put a bow on this. I'm very much in favor of a third party. I want one of these parties to kill one of these parties. I want some new party to kill one of these parties. But I don't want any party. And I don't want a party that goes in that makes our politics worse and doesn't achieve the things that it sets out to achieve. It's just not my, it's not a good argument for it. And so, like, when it comes to Robert O. Kennedy, you know, and I got some grief from people about this. They were like, oh, you'd prefer Biden or Trump to Robert F. Kennedy. I want to be real clear. I don't want any of these people to be president of the United States. But in some ways, I'd be more terrified of Robert Kennedy presidency. They all fall short of my minimal standards for people who would want to be president of the United States. But I can have, I honestly have more respect for the arguments for taking a flyer with Biden again than I do with the arguments for taking a flyer with Trump again. That doesn't mean I think everybody who's going to vote for Trump is a bad person or wrong. And it doesn't mean everybody who I think is going to vote for Biden is a good person or right. But I just, you know, it to me, it's very much like the PGA Work thing of unacceptable within normal parameters and unacceptable within abnormal parameters. And Robert F. Kennedy and Donald Trump are unacceptable well outside of abnormal parameters. And I just, for me, part of it is just a drop dead thing about how if you screwed with the peaceful transfer of power in this country, you should be forbidden from being in public office ever again. That doesn't mean I necessarily buy the 14th Amendment argument on the particulars, but the spirit of that argument, I think, is entirely sound and valid. And I think if we were in a healthier country, you wouldn't have to talk about the 14th Amendment because it would just be obvious that Donald Trump should never be in office again. Oh, and so speaking of commenters, Cynthia, a regular listener and reader, she criticized my Wednesday G-File for saying it felt like it just ended abruptly. I was just getting going when it ended. And I want to say Cynthia's got a good eye. I had to do the podcast and then I got started on the G-File and then I had to go to AI to speak to a group of grad students about conservative stuff. And that went longer than I planned. And then I had to have a meeting that went longer than I planned. And so then I just had to get the thing done. And so it's one of those G-files where I really like the idea and I really wish I had a little more space and time to do it right. But by the time I got back to it, I was like, okay, I just got to bring this thing in for a landing. The basic argument, which dovetails with the stuff I was just saying, is, you know, Robert F. Kennedy said on this interview with Aaron Burnett, I think on Monday night, that echoing Donald Trump, because again, he is using Trump's arguments against Biden. He's not using Biden's arguments against Trump because he is very clearly, to my mind, decided that he would rather be a spoiler that hurts Democrats than Republicans. Take that what you will. But he said, you know, Joe Biden is the first president of the United States to censor his political opponents. He's the first president of the United States to weaponize government agencies against his political opponents. And he went on in this vein. And we can talk about how that's exactly Trump's talking point. Trump has said that stuff a zillion times. We can talk about the fact that the censorship that he's alleging is, I really think, pretty tenuous. You know, we can argue about it, about whether some government officials overstepped in their pressure on social media platforms not to put out all sorts of anti-vax stuff. And I think there are some examples of overstepping. But the Biden administration, to my understanding, and I'm open to correction about this, there are a lot of people I think have just wildly overhyped this story. But the Biden administration wasn't going after political opponents. It was going, rightly or wrongly, again, we can have that argument, against people who were putting all of this sort of anti-vaccination BS out into the world. And I think that public health profession, the mainstream media, social media platforms screwed up pretty royally in how they handled legitimate dissenting scientific opinion on the vaccine stuff. They overcompensated because they could not tolerate the idea that Anthony Fauci might be wrong on some particular. I think they panicked. They screwed up in various ways. We can argue about whether it came from a good place. We can argue about whether or not a more constrained form of crackdown would be warranted. Personally, I think, you know, people who are telling you that you know, I got no problem with social media platforms in theory taking down, you know, accounts that are saying if you get vaccinated, Bill Gates is going to have mind control chips in your bloodstream. I think there were a lot of people, the Charlie Kirk types, the Alex Jones types, were pushing dangerous nonsense for their own benefit. And I wouldn't publish any of that garbage on the Dispatch. And I understand Section 230 arguments and all the rest. It's a little different for social media platforms, but the sanctimony and self-righteousness from people talking about how outrageous it was that the government, you know, regulated speech, you know, blah, 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 when it came to this set of issues, I think a lot of that is just overblown. And I know people have very strong opinions about that, and we can have those arguments. But the only reason I got into that rabbit hole is that's what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was doing. He wasn't a candidate. He wasn't a political opponent. He's a crank, and a charlatan, and he was spewing nonsense, and he was went and Instagram took down his account or whatever. And whether or not the Biden administration was responsible for that or pressured Instagram, I honestly don't know. And frankly, I just don't give that big a rat's ass. I just don't think that the First Amendment issues that people want to imbue this stuff with are nearly as ripe as they think they are. But I could be wrong about that. But again, my point is just factually, it's a lie that anybody was censoring Robert F. Kennedy because he was a political opponent for the incumbent president in 2021. It's just BS. But the thing that really just sort of really offended me is just the absolute historical bullshit, the amnesia. You know, these guys have, you know, as I wrote about borrowing from Ted Lasso, they have the memory of a goldfish. The idea that Joe Biden, let's just say he did weaponize government agencies, which at the margins I'm open to, you know, fine. You know, like, let's just say, stipulate that he did, how bad it was, how egregious it was, how outrageous it was. We can argue about another day, but let's just sort of, you know, for argument's sake, say he did that. The idea that he was the first one in American history to do that, let's say that he did censor a political opponent, which I don't think he did. The idea that he was the first president in history to do that, it's just nonsense. You know, and so I went on about the Woodrow Wilson stuff where he censored political opponents. He put Eugene V. Debs in prison. Eugene V. Debs ran for president from prison in 2020, not against Woodrow Wilson, but Woodrow Wilson was the guy who kept him there. It was Warren Harding who let the last of Wilson's political prisoners out of jail. Woodrow Wilson unleashed the American Protective League on the United States of America, where over 250,000 goons with quasi-official authority from the U.S. government spied on people, bugged people, turned people in, interrogated people. Newspapers were shut down. Magazines were shut down. At least 1,000 people were put in federal prison by the Wilson Justice Department for criticizing the war. One guy who said that, you know, Vladimir Lenin was the brainiest guy in the world was sent to jail, I think, for 6 months. Another guy who made a documentary about the American Revolution that painted the British in a bad light, I think he got a 10-year sentence. The Wilson administration encouraged or did not discourage vigilante violence and lynching against inauthentic Americans. I mean, you can go down a very long list of things. And obviously, I can't resist the bait to bash Wilson, but Wilson's not alone. FDR censored. FDR targeted political opponents. Richard Nixon, at the very least, wanted to. John Adams crossed the line. Abraham Lincoln, praise be upon him, shut down newspapers, you know, declared war against a political opponent. I mean, anyway, you can go down a very long list of abuses and excesses. And when Robert F. Kennedy says this, he either doesn't know it, which should at least make him have a little more humility in his bloviating jackassery, or he does know it and he's just a profound liar. Like, I'm more inclined to think that Kennedy is a liar because I think he's smart enough and compos mentis enough just to lie. I think Trump, you know, and he says this all the time, this has never happened before, Biden's the first person to do this, he's the real threat to democracy, yada, yada, yada. I believe Trump is telling the truth because I don't think he knows anything about American history. And, you know, I point out Biden's a little different. He actually does talk about American history in a way that sounds informed. The problem is he just makes stuff up or gets stuff wrong or misremembers things. You know, FDR did not go on TV after the 1929 stock market crash and reassure the American people because he wasn't president and no one had TVs back then. And you can go on and on and on, right? The point I wanted to make that I really wanted to explore more, and I wanted to get into some Israel stuff and some other things, and so I do want to return to this point, is that it's one thing for us to have this, you know, as the headline was, gerontocracy of blowhards, right? I think the one thing that they all have in common, regardless of their historical understanding or command, is they're blowhards. They just make stuff up. They exaggerate, they self-aggrandize rhetorically to the maximum. They have this sort of narcissistic thing that they are the most important person in history and that anything bad to them is a historic outrage. and it's all exhausting old man BS. The more troubling thing is how few Americans either care or know how wrong these guys are. I think one of our big problems, and it's not, and this is where Cynthia's right, I kind of screwed up the G file. It's a real problem when the electorate, I'm not saying every listener to this podcast, I'm not saying, I know it's not every listener to this podcast because I get so much stuff correcting me about stuff I get wrong accidentally about history or wanting more history podcasts and all that kind of stuff. But this podcast is called The Remnant for a reason. Nor is it true that, you know, a lot of elites are completely ignorant of history. I mean, I think a lot are, but I don't think it's like you can generalize about all of this. Nor do I think it's true of like every voter. But the median voter, the majority makers, the ones, certainly the ones who are going to decide this election, but also the hardcore ideologues and, you know, and populist types on the left and the right, they have goldfish memory problems. They think that, you know, it's that they're living in the fierce urgency of now. And what is so weird is like on the right, you know, wing, you know, a lot of these people were former Tea Party people. And it's like they don't even remember whether you believe it's true or not. That's not the point. They believed it was true that Barack Obama weaponized the IRS against his political enemies. They believed, and you know, were right that the administration literally weaponized weapons politically in the Fast and Furious thing to go after the gun industry. And they invented this fraud. They did this terrible thing. We don't need to get into, that's another rabbit hole we could go down. But like, in living memory for a lot of these people, they know that this first president to weaponize government agencies stuff is nonsense because they believe that Barack Obama did it. They believe that Bill Clinton did it. I mean, we could do chapter and verse about this kind of stuff. And meanwhile, you know, the left, which thinks, you know, that things have gotten worse racially in this country, they should know better. It's not like America's civil rights history and, you know, racial history is not taught in schools. You know, there are a lot of things that should be taught in schools that have been pushed out so we can talk about, we can teach that stuff more. And the idea that like, you know, Georgia's election law, whether you think it was bad or really bad or evil or fine or whatever, it was not Bull Connor, right? It was not Jim Crow 2.0 or Jim Crow on steroids or Jim Eagle or any of that sort of nonsense. And I think this goldfish memory problem is a real problem for a democracy. And I don't know how much of it stems from actual historical ignorance and how much of it stems from a desire, you know, the sort of main character syndrome stuff I've been talking about, this desire that, you know, the times we are living in, that you are living in, have to be super important, that has to be full of unprecedented significance, that it allows us to sort of tune out facts and memory about how, you know, crime has in fact been much worse in this country than it is right now or than it was in 2016. You know, I wrote about this a little while ago about, you know, there are polls saying that Americans think, large numbers of Americans think America's worse off now than it was 50 years ago. And, you know, that recency bias is nuts. I mean, people may be more unsettled because of social media or late capitalism or because they know what time it is or whatever. That's a topic for another day. But the idea that Americans are worse off economically or in terms of crime or even unrest than we were, you know, a half century ago. It's crazy. There was a string of horrible assassinations in this country, including Robert F. Kennedy's dad, right? Martin Luther King was assassinated a half century ago. All these weird old ladies kept trying to kill Gerry Ford. You had the FBI director. I think it was the FBI director. It might've been the field office guy, but you know, saying that San Francisco was the Belfast of North America in like 1976. You had large numbers of domestic terrorist bombings in the United States of America every day for like 18 months. You know, the homicide rate, forget 50 years ago, the homicide rate, you know, starts to climb in the 60s and reaches its peak in the 90, 91, something like that. Just far exceeds what we're going through now. That is not to say everyone should be fine with the crime rate. I mean, part of the infuriating thing with the crime rate today is it's because of a version of this goldfish memory problem, is that people think, oh, well, crime is a thing of the past, so we don't have to do the things that prevent crime anymore. We don't have to do the things that keep kids in school. I mean, absenteeism is through the roof. I mean, you just go down a long list. You know, there were a bunch of people who thought inflation was this myth, right? Like it was a boogeyman. And you can make a case that the right was kind of wrong about inflation in the 2010s. But you can definitely make the case that, you know, parts of the left, you know, were the Green New Deal left, the $1 trillion coin left, the there's nothing wrong with Social Security, we can just print money left, really believe that like fears of inflation were just irrational and outrageous hindrance on their ambitions. That's, you know, one of the reasons that's, you know, the inflation thing is a complicated one. But one of the reasons why we got inflation was because a lot of people believed that inflation wasn't a problem anymore. And if you actually had if you actually thought the dangers of inflation were around the corner, you would not have done the things Biden did early in his administration. Like, there are always going to be more politicians who want to spend a lot more money. But the argument that, hey, if you do this, we can get inflation back is going to have real bite, because people now recognize how much inflation pisses voters off. And regardless, like this inability to hold on to some hard-earned lessons about governance and social order and economics is one of the reasons why our politics is a mess. And it's not just a problem with our elected leaders, it's a problem with voters. And I personally think it's, you know, it's the offshoot of populism. It's not monocausal. It has to do with really crappy things in education. It has to do with a lot of things. It has to do with, you know, bad journalism. I mean, I could come up with a long list for you, but I do think that one of the things that fuels it is populism, because populism is about anger and immediacy. The arrogant urgency of, you know, the fierce arrogance of now, right? We have to do this now. We are the ones we've been waiting for. This is our moment. You know, the time for debate is over. These are populist sentiments that have defined left and right for a while now. And we only talk these days about the populism of the right for understandable and defensible reasons, because I think it's more intense and more off the rails these days. But 10 years ago, 12 years ago, the populism of the left was worse. I mean, I'll defend the early Tea Parties over Occupy Wall Street crowd any day of the week. But regardless, you know, like, this is the problem with populism, is that it privileges emotion and passion and anger over argument and reason and facts and memory. One of the core tools for any reasonable, rational, fact-based argument is an appeal to history. It's what every smart economist does, is they go back and they do time series and they look what happened in the past. It's what every policymaker does, is you learn from history, right? Edmund Burke, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. I don't like all the trite, he who forgets history is doomed to repeat it, but, you know, obviously there's truth to it. We keep making the same stupid mistakes because we don't want to think the past has any binding power over our capabilities in the present and the future. And that's a product of populism. You've heard me talk about my favorite quote from William Jennings Bryan, you know, it was the sort of avatar of populism in the 19th century. And he says, you know, the people of Nebraska are for free silver, therefore I am for free silver. I will look up the arguments later. Well, those arguments against free silver had something to do with history, had something to do with it. Well, you know, we tried that before and it didn't work. And this combination of recency bias and populist, you know, agitation and the arrogance of thinking that, you know, this my moment has to be different and I'm not beholden to the past, and probably a dozen other things, is leading to a national goldfish memory problem. And I think it applies to Israel too, but we don't have time to get into all of that, you know. But this idea that somehow it's like Israel's the one country in the world who doesn't get the benefit of the goldfish memory problem. Israel's a lot older. Well, I shouldn't say a lot older. Israel is older than a lot of countries. A lot of countries became independent in the 1960s. Israel is as old as quite a few countries that we think have been around forever. And I'm not talking about the argument that Israel was in the Bible. I'm talking about like the Israel founded in 1948. Go to the, there's a Wikipedia page. I wrote about this. You can go find my column. You know, you look at the founding dates of a lot of countries as independent sovereign nations under international law. Israel's a lot older than Ukraine. Ukraine became a country under international law in like 91. But because a lot of people who don't know jack about history buy these really stupid arguments about how Israel is this white settler colonial European country that didn't exist ever and has no claim and has no indigeneity to the land, and that the adherents of this religion that is thousands of years younger than Judaism, they are the only authentic and indigenous people to the area. It's just weird. The weaponization and selective weaponization of historical ignorance is just something that just drives me crazy. So with that, I actually got to go. I'm making dinner. Thank you for listening. We'll figure out what happens next week soon enough. Please, if you can subscribe to The Dispatch, do so. Thank you very much for all the kind words about the podcasts this week with Sadanand Dume. I know I mispronounced it. And Carolina Hurd. I thought they were great. Check out The Dispatch podcast. Listen to those episodes at AO. And again, please subscribe to The Dispatch. And I'll talk to you next time.